So
you're skeptical.
Yes. Following up.
Uh-huh.
On a discussion.
Yes.
From a recent episode.
Uh-huh.
In which you said that you felt the hairstyling in Marie Antoinette.
Yes.
Was a mixture of 17th or 18th century and 90s aughts hairstylings.
Yes.
And I rightly.
You were very skeptical of me.
Rightly called bullshit because you don't know what you're talking about hairstylings.
Fucking
of
whatever.
Any decade or century.
Who did you talk to?
Well, I was reading that Vogue oral history of Marie Antoinette. Did a little control F right up front. Hairstyling. 10 paragraphs on the wardrobe. One brief mention of the hairstyling.
Yeah.
Nothing to confirm nor deny either of our assertions. So, as I said I would in the episode, I followed up with friend of the show, Pri.
Uh-huh.
Pri, extremely fashionable and knowledgeable person about such things.
Yes.
Pri reluctantly, though she agreed with me that it was the right instinct to doubt you, shared with me just a few images from the movie, and she said, these do look fairly contemporary.
Thank you very much, Pri. I appreciate you. And Scott, f*** you. No, thank you. Thank you for doing the legwork to confirm my out-of-pocket remarks.
But thank you, Pri. Thank you to me for the humility to admit that I may have been incorrect. Though also thank you to Pri for backing me up that it is not incorrect to suspect that you are incorrect.
Rude.
You, Jamie, not Pri.
Very rude. Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome.
It's a podcast about movies and wine. And for those of you who don't know shit about one or both of those topics, my name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
Jamie.
What are you doing?
I don't know.
Are you sure you took your meds today?
Yes. I watched a couple Bob Fosse musicals this week, and now I'm thinking about musicals.
Jazz hands.
The audience couldn't see me doing jazz hands. He's Jamie. I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy. Your movie guy. A movie human. Each episode, Jamie picks a wine. I pick a movie. Not always in that order. We pair them. We usually like them. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. Who knows? We tell you why. They're made, they work, maybe they don't. Pairings. Here we go.
This was the best intro we've ever done.
By far.
It's part 4 of our mini-series, A Philadelphia Tasting Menu.
Exclamation point.
I didn't do it good enough. A Philadelphia Tasting Menu.
It was better the first time.
I did it with jazz hands that time.
They were not sincere. You didn't even raise your arms up all the way.
You were just
leaning on the armrests. Yeah. It was like a shrug jazz hands.
It's like,
Jazz hands. I don't know.
Oh, boy. So for this mini series, I decided that since we talk so much about food on this show and Scott complains frequently that I don't give him enough notice for food pairings.
You don't give me food pairings.
Sometimes on microphone, I give you food
which
pairings.
Is not notice because I've already consumed the wine at that point. That is not notice.
That's true.
That is after the fact. Anyway, I don't complain about that frequently because I've just resigned myself.
You complain about it pretty frequently. I feel like you've cut it out of most of the episodes, but you do complain about it.
If it's not in the episode, then it never happened, Jamie. It wasn't canon. The show has canon, okay?
I know the show has canon. Johnny Words is dead, RIP.
Your words.
So I decided that I wanted to talk about the thing that wine is supposed to go with, which is food. So I put together a list of some of my favorite Philadelphia restaurants and contacted the owners to see what dishes they wanted to showcase.
And on the movie side of things, I picked 6 movies that in one way or another explore the power of food, in particular about the meals that are shared. And, you know, your mileage may vary as to how effective those semi-connected food pairings have been. As I have said for the past 3 episodes, I will reiterate today, Jamie picked a dish. Then he picked a wine. I paired a movie to the wine, not to the dish. I do not want to be judged on that metric, nor do I feel that the restaurant or the chefs or the dish should feel in any way judged or compared to the movies that I have selected.
That's right. This Venn diagram that we've created is like 3/5 of the Olympic logo.
Sure. Okay. That's good.
For our fourth dish, I contacted Chris D'Ambro and Marina De Oliveira of Southwark Restaurant. As some of you may know, Southwork was my former employer. I worked with Chris and Marina to open two restaurants. We ended up running four restaurants together. And now I am the consulting wine director, and also I run a wine pop-up at that restaurant every Monday evening. So I really love Southwork. It feels like home to me. I also truly love Chris's food. He and I, one of the reasons we worked really, really well together when we were working together daily was our ideas of flavor really overlap. He likes bombastic flavors, but he also likes really clean flavors. And so when I went to him with this idea, he immediately suggested his yearly tomato spaghetti. This is a thing he does every summer when heirloom tomatoes are abundant in our region. And it's basically the only cooked version of tomato that I like to have during peak tomato season.
Well, because otherwise it's fairly wasteful of your fresh tomatoes.
I agree. But this, I think, is a really great way to experience the fresh flavor of a tomato in a hot dish. Because you're not cooking it that much. You're just heating it enough to like break it down a little bit to coat the spaghetti. Mm. And it's a really, really simple recipe. A little garlic, a little white wine, some butter, some tomatoes, some fresh oregano, some parm. Done. It's wonderful. The pasta program at Southwork, I think, is one of the best in the city. You should go try it. The kitchen is open Tuesday through Saturday every week.
All right. Now, I'm going to put Chris on blast here, potentially.
Yes.
I haven't been to Southwark in a few years, you know, for undisclosed reasons.
For reasons,
for
yes.
Reasons. Is the squid ink, was it fettuccine or linguine?
That you had, oh God, that was a while ago.
That was 2+ years ago. But it seemed like every time I went there, that was on the menu until it stopped being on the menu. And I got very disappointed every time I came to Southwark because that fucking squid ink pasta was out of this world.
It was squid ink was with gone. Like a bunch of, he was doing a bunch of different seafood in it too, right? Like it was like shrimp, calamari.
I don't really remember. I like vaguely remember like chopped clams or something. Yeah, in it, but I don't remember all the rest of it. It could have been, yeah, calamari or, yeah.
I think it was a melange of seafood,
yes.
if I recall correctly.
Well, it was outstanding.
That
I
is
miss
not
it.
Currently on the menu.
Well, then I guess I'm not coming to Southwark.
I mean, other great things are on the menu.
Is the squid ink pasta on the menu?
No.
Because that will draw me out of my bunker for an outdoor dining experience if the timing and available childcare is convenient to me.
I mean, you should
and if
do
gas
the
is
outdoor
less expensive.
At Southwark either way, because it's one of the best. Like, Laver 2, I already talked about their outdoor experience being fabulous. Southwark, for me, is the other one that I immediately think about for outdoor dining in Philly. The patio is, like, secluded. Like, you can't see it from the street,
yeah.
Sort of off in kind of an alleyway. Absolutely beautiful. Has like a pergola over it with fans, and it's beautiful. It's magical out there.
But
tons
I want that
plants.
Squid ink pasta.
Listen, man, I don't control the menu over there. It's the whims of the chef.
All right. Well, I'm just saying, Mr. Chef, if you're listening to this episode.
He definitely is not.
That squid ink pasta was unreal, and I miss it greatly.
So that's the spaghetti alla chitarra with heirloom tomatoes at Southwork. You should get it. The wine I paired with that dish, another absolute favorite of mine that feels like home to me, Bedrock Wine Company, Ode to Lulu Rosé 2021, available at Crush Wine Company for $24.
Plus shipping.
Plus tax and shipping.
Well, the wine. Jamie told me that this wine needs time, parentheses, to age and or decant. Homage that it's powerful for a rosé. It is pale, and he claims that it defies expectations. To which I paired 2019's Midsommar. This is the second feature film from writer-director Ari Aster, and as of this episode's recording, it is available to stream via Showtime.
Which I forgot to cancel, and I paid for a month's subscription.
Well, you know what? There's all kinds of good shit on Showtime.
I'll have to ask you for a list.
They have like an A24 page, and you can just watch
all the A24s.
They have like a crazy A24 deal. They'll probably have everything everywhere all at once fairly shortly.
Nice.
Anyway, get it on Showtime or wherever you rent or buy your VOD movies. There's also a director's cut version of the movie, which is available, but it's tricky, and maybe we'll talk about that later. I was annoyed. I thought I was watching the director's cut, and then Apple wouldn't let me.
Have you seen the director's cut?
No.
Okay.
I've heard mixed things. Some people say it is needlessly a half hour longer. A friend of the show, Justin, is a huge advocate for it and says it's a better version of the movie. I wanted to watch it, and I even convinced Tani to watch the 3-hour version of it with me and not the, like, 2-hour, 35-minute version. And then I fucking bought it and booted it up, and Apple's like, we're the exclusive place if you want to watch the director's cut of Midsommar, but only if you watch it on, like, a $250 Apple TV or on your computer.
That's so fucking
Which is
stupid.
Annoying. So, like, I buy it, and then I go to boot it up on my Chromecast, and you can't watch it at all. Blessedly, to Apple's credit, after I watched the entire movie that I paid for from them, I've requested a refund, and they refunded it, no questions asked. This is not interesting. No one cares about this. Moving on.
Yeah, moving right along. We have some business to attend to.
We do. Before we talk about wine, food, or movie, we must address the elephant in the room. And the elephant is, we do not have any new reviews this week.
No new reviews.
As part of an ongoing carrot and stick segment, we might as well just call it carrot and stick. We've got certs and veg already. Now we've got carrots and sticks.
Sure. That is canonically what it's called.
Sure.
Now.
Well, I'll definitely remember this next time. To encourage people to leave reviews, which, as previously mentioned, helps the show and it helps an audience find the show, which also helps us and helps that audience in theory, unless they hate the show. I have been carrot telling the audience that if in their reviews on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform allows you to leave reviews, if they mention their favorite Marvel movie, that I will make Jamie watch it. And Jamie has been very good about watching them so far. And if for the new episode we do not have a new review, I will punish the audience and I guess also Jamie, who just complains about like having to listen to the things that are going on in my life.
For a second time. I've already heard all of this shit.
That is not true. You haven't heard about what I'm going to talk about today. Break the podcaster listener contract and make you all hear me complain about the ongoing saga of renovating my bathroom. Now, Jamie, we do not have any new reviews today.
But we had a late addition to a review that we read aloud on the pod 2 episodes ago.
That, I believe, is correct.
So Mary Catherine Vecco, who is an international listener from British Columbia, emailed us her Apple Pods review because she is outside of the United States, and for whatever reason, those reviews don't post.
I'm sure Apple has a reason for it, but like Apple's reasons for most things, it is very opaque.
Right. Veiled in secrecy for no good reason. You know, her review was very kind, and she suggested a wine and also a movie, both of which are difficult to find, and we will address those at some point.
In due time.
But then she followed up and asked me to watch Black Widow.
What did you think of Black Widow?
First of all, I'd like everyone to know that when Black Widow came out and Scott first watched it, he came into our movie chat hot about it.
Well, because it's bad.
You hated it. And, you know, generally, Scott and I tend to agree about movies. Black Widow got dropped in our email and I was, you know, looking at the ground trying to think of an excuse to not watch this thing.
Nope. She fulfilled her end of the bargain.
She absolutely did.
Left us her review and then asked you to watch Black Widow.
So I put it on.
You put it on.
And I got to say, I was pleasantly surprised.
All right.
I enjoyed my viewing experience of this more than I enjoyed Thor Ragnarok.
Wow. A section of our listenership just exploded with rage and confusion. That's amazing.
It has earnestness. And when it makes jokes, they don't deflate the drama.
Yeah.
Like it actually has some kind of an ear for tone. The emotional thing, like the emotional thrust of the movie, I found to be pretty interesting. I like the chemistry between Flo Pugh and ScarJo. I think that they play off each other really well. I really didn't like what's his name? The guy with the red costume.
David Harbour as the Crimson guy.
The Crimson whatever, the Russian guy.
Yeah.
I did not like that at all.
Yeah.
And the resolution of his story and then also Rachel Weisz's story I thought was kind of weird and not great. But I, in the end, kind of enjoyed my time watching the movie and was not pissed that I had watched it. I don't think it's great. I don't think that it is, you know, a thing that I'll remember next year.
I would be surprised if you remembered it next week, but okay. All right.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised.
All right, Jamie. Well, then I think you have to be less reluctant to watch the other Marvel movies because I was pleasantly surprised and I enjoyed myself and I might not remember it next year is kind of like the par for that franchise, especially at this point. You know what I really like about that movie is the first 10 minutes when it's just like the Americans, when they're like deep cover yes. Russian operatives and they have to escape and all of that is super cool.
They give
cool.
you a lot of really great POV from the kids, mm-hmm. like the wonder of living it through a child's eyes. I was like, oh, this is
yeah,
like this is thoughtful
yep.
and interesting.
All of that is cool. And then
it launches into this credit sequence where you're glossing over years of trauma.
Well, but the credit sequence is part of my issue with the movie because the credit sequence just makes it explicit. Like, oh, this movie's about human trafficking.
Right.
And then it's really not.
Then it's really not.
Anymore. You're it's right. not about human trafficking. And like everybody points to the scene where Red, whatever, Russian Captain America makes a joke about, oh, are you on your period or something? And Florence Pugh, like, rightfully shuts him down, and she gets a great moment. And then the movie doesn't address trauma, like, at all,
right.
ever again. And it's like
that was one of my problems with it.
The surrogate family sits down together for a meal, and they make a couple of jokes, and then, like, suddenly the betrayal of these parents is just forgiven. They sold their daughters into sex slavery, essentially. And it's just, it's okay because we had a couple of jokes and he played her favorite song and now we're cool. And we move along because the plot requires us to go and jump out of an exploding sky fortress or something.
Right. If you analyze it for even a moment, it falls entirely apart.
Right. If you are an active participatory audience member, it holds up to no scrutiny at all. But if it's just, you know, the latest thing on the Disney Plus slurry, it's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, it frustrated me. It really frustrated me. And I like Scarlett. I have always liked her. I've always liked her in that role, even though Black Widow is basically a different character in every movie that she shows up in. I always liked Scarlett as Natasha. It was way past overdue for her to actually get her own movie. They waited until, spoilers, Jamie, they killed her off in a movie
I know.
Preceding this one give her own
right.
movie. And it seems that her emotional journey over the course of this film is to get a vest, because that vest is very significant,
it's
Jamie, because
that's the vest.
Well, that's the vest that she wears when she returns in Avengers Infinity War. So this is really just the saga of how she got the vest. I can think of no other emotional through line for the character that actually holds up except for
she got a vest.
She got a vest. And I guess now she has to decide to get the team back together or something. Anyway, it's fine. And Florence Pugh is outstanding in the movie.
She's awesome.
Yeah. Also, why in the Christ do they... You're just reminding me of all the things that annoy me about this movie. Opening 10 minutes, they do the Americans thing, right?
Yeah.
David Harbour, Rachel Weisz, Russian spies living in America, perfect American accents, because that's what spies would do. They would have flawless American accents. So why in the shit... when they return, we come back to them in the story 20 minutes or 20 years later, do they sound like Boris and Natasha?
I'll say this. He did not he came into that first little bit with a Russian accent.
I don't know. I clearly have blanked much of the movie
right.
from my
And
memory.
I was like, this is weird. Why does he have a Russian accent?
But then he comes back later and he's worse than Kenneth Branagh in Tenet.
That's correct.
Jamie's
yes.
favorite movie.
I can talk shit.
But you like Black Widow. That's insane. Okay. I have to recalibrate some things now. My understanding of you is really shifted. Couldn't get down with Tenet. Black Widow's okay, though.
I guess I'm just...
Wild. That's okay.
It's an expectations game also, because as I mentioned, you were gnashing and fucking like frothing at the mouth
yeah.
after this film.
Yeah.
And I watched it and I was like, that was kind of okay.
Yeah.
And like the big takeaway for me, which I already mentioned, was like that it doesn't deflate itself at every fucking corner.
Yeah.
The way that Ragnarok did.
It was something I was talking with Lerman about the other day. He was asking me what I thought of Thor, Love Thunder, and I was complaining about that constant deflation. You know,
right.
that if you're constantly undercutting yourself with jokes, then you're not undercutting anything. You're just making jokes and telling me that I don't have to take it seriously, and at least the joke should be funny. Like, and he countered with, well, what about Black Widow? Like, that, for all of its faults, that movie takes itself seriously, and it does, and that's fine. I don't know. My thing is that, like, and I'm very unforgiving of the Marvel movies at this point. Like, when I come in hot and say that I hated it, it's not that it's incompetently. I mean, I think some of them are kind of incompetently made and kind of bland to look at. And, you know,
yeah.
the pre-production, post-production pipeline just kind of is a factory. It's an assembly line, and there's no room for style or flavor. But no, I just, like, they're all missed opportunities. Like, this movie, it's the Disney company. They were never going to make a movie about human trafficking and young women being sex trafficked. So why even dip their toes into the waters of suggesting it might be a movie about that?
Right.
You know, you could have done something. You have the meat there, and you have two fucking great actresses who could have done an amazing story about that. And instead, it's just like human trafficking and childhood trauma is just window dressing for more popcorn horseshit.
Right. And anything that could have been about the human trafficking or the trauma ends up just being about a personal vendetta with the guy.
Right. Who then, whatever, I don't want to talk about this movie anymore. I'm sincerely glad you didn't hate it.
Because it
amuses me when you hate these things, but I'm glad that you didn't feel that this was subjected upon you.
It was subjected upon me, and like for sure, a year from now, I won't be able to recall anything about it, and that'll be fine.
Well, anyway, if you want to hear more about Jamie enjoying the dregs of the Marvel franchise, please leave us a review. Let us know what your favorite Marvel movie is. We'll even make exceptions. Maybe you want him to watch the Snyder Cut.
Oh, my God.
It's still out there. Jamie, there's a black and white version you can watch, too.
How about Age of Ultron? I'll watch that.
I have the 4K sitting right over there in the other room. But someone has to suggest that you watch it first.
Right. Yeah. I can't go watching these movies now.
No.
If someone suggests it and I go, oh, I've already seen that one.
Yeah.
Except for the ones that I have already seen.
That's right. But since we don't have a new review this week, I will briefly regale you with the latest updates in my ongoing saga to renovate my bathroom.
And this one I haven't heard, so I'm not going to complain. I'm going to be a good friend.
Son of a bitch. It's actually not that. It's not even complaining. It's just I did some things. So last time I talked about it, we were not thrilled with the color of the paint in the room. So I've made some changes. I'm in the process of replacing all the hardware in the bathroom, which was before a mixture of, like, you know, like a high gloss brass or like a brushed pewter or nickel type color. And now I'm replacing all the hardware with black, just matte black metal.
I like the black light fixture that you put
in. Well, spoilers.
All right.
We've got some like nice, like black metal, like wire metal baskets for towels and toiletries and stuff around the general toilet area. I've replaced the towel hooks and such with black metal. I have a new faucet that I have to install. I've never installed a faucet before. I'm sure it'll take 10 times longer than I think it will, but I have a new black faucet to put in. Probably, maybe I'll replace the doorknobs too with black metal. And then the light fixture. That was the big thing. That was the thing that was going to fix the color, because I didn't like the light fixture that we had anyway. So I got an LED black, sort of like Art Deco looking light fixture.
Art Deco-ish, I guess.
Ish. It's fine. It's okay. But the important thing is that I can change the color temperature. And so it has five different color temperatures of white.
That is such a Scott thing to do.
But it changes. When we're done, I will show you downstairs. This is the only setting that the walls look good in.
Great.
And I knew that this was the solution because we started changing different light bulbs. Because I always like the warmer tone LED light bulbs.
Right.
The blue ones always look like, you know, like fluorescent tubes. They look like work, and that's awful and sucks the soul out of me. But this green was like so strong that I put in some like old CFLs that we had that were a little bit more bluish, and it was like, oh, the walls look kind of better now. So now new fixture, went blue. Through the different settings, and this is the second coolest temperature light fixture. I believe this is in the 3000K range is the color temperature of the light. And now
next week for our podcast on light temperature.
And Jamie liking bad Marvel movies. That's your new rap. Jamie likes Marvel movies, but only the bad ones. He doesn't like everybody's favorite, Thor Ragnarok, but Black Widow, Jamie thinks is great.
I didn't say great.
Now you should watch The Eternals, which no one likes except for me. And maybe you'll like that one.
The Eternals is one that I'm interested in watching.
It's not one that, like, good. It's not good, but it's more interesting than anything they've put out in a while.
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah. Yeah, Chloe Zhao, she's like a filmmaker.
Right.
Yeah, but it's not good. But it's interesting.
Sure.
Yeah.
Whatever. Can we talk about our podcast now? Are we done talking about your bathroom?
I don't know. Are we done talking about, well, wait, I got a new shower curtain too. That's all. I got a new shower curtain. It's cloth. I guess I need to get a liner now.
You do need a liner. Yes.
You have to have a liner.
I didn't know that.
I've always had like a vinyl or a plastic shower curtain before. So now I need to get a liner.
Scotty.
Shut up, Jamie. Like, you even have a shower curtain.
I have a shower curtain and a liner. Thank you very much.
Anyway, Jamie, I'm tired of talking about my bathroom. I know you're very interested, but you need to stop dragging this out. You're dragging out the Black Widow thing. You're asking too many thoughtful follow-up questions about the bathroom. Let's talk about the food first.
Food.
This was a delicious meal.
Wasn't it fucking delightful?
Oh, man.
In-season tomatoes, folks.
Yeah.
Eat them when they're fresh.
When they're fresh and ripe.
Your grocery store tomatoes in December are bullshit.
Grocery store tomatoes in general.
In general,
are bad. I basically only eat like fresh tomatoes in the summer when they come off my father-in-law's vines. Like,
that's
because he grows tomatoes and they're my favorite tomatoes. Our father bird's tomatoes. They're growing right out by the pool right now.
You hear that, everyone? Come out to Doylestown, steal father bird's tomatoes.
You back the fuck away from the tomatoes here on the compound, okay? Stay away from my tomatoes. They're mine. They're not mine, but they're not yours.
Anyway, yes, I agree. Generally, eating in season is just a joy. It allows you to like take a break from some things and revisit them as they come back into season. It's blueberry season here in the mid-Atlantic. This new development, also corn season. I love this time of year. I just made myself some corn pasta last night. But these damn tomatoes, it's such a simple preparation.
Yeah.
Sweat down your tomatoes a little bit and then mount it with butter. And it's like creamy and delicious and so good.
With the fresh pasta. Yep. Yeah, it was delightful. Because so often when I think of, like, not when I order out, but like when I'm at home, like pasta goes with a tomato sauce.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's fine and delicious. And it doesn't have to be like chunky and heavy and weigh you down. But yeah, it was just like, it's very simple and the flavors all pop. And I had it with this bedrock wine. I thought it was good with the wine too, which I, you know, it's not in my way to always credit you for pairing successes, but I thought this was very good with the wine.
I appreciate it.
I thought the acid in the tomatoes nicely reflected the acid in the rosé. There's like a little bit of a bitterness in this rosé, not definitely overwhelming, and that went nicely with the
sweetness of the tomatoes.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. It was great. It was so refreshing. God, it smelled so good too. Highly recommended.
I'm glad that you liked it. I also obviously love it. You know, having worked with Chris for a while, it's the kind of thing that, you know, I love when this season comes around, selfishly for the tomatoes that I bring into my own house, but also for this dish to come on the menu at Southwark, because it's just, it screams summertime.
Now, question.
Yes.
Why, not to make you defend a dish that you did not create.
Yes.
Why oregano? Why not? And this is just me being like a basic with my...
Just
with
asking.
No, just like, why not basil, for example? I don't know. When I think like Italian and pasta and sauces, maybe it's just because I like pesto, but I always want to reach for the basil plant first.
They're both Mediterranean herbs. I mean, oregano is a constituent of most tomato sauces that you're going to see. And to use fresh in season oregano with fresh in season tomatoes works. Basil would work as well. But as you say, you think about it very, very quickly and easily. And it's like, the flavor combination that you see in like a caprese salad is basil and tomato. And so to do something just on the other side of expected, not that oregano is not expected, but I think oregano is also an herb that most people encounter exclusively dried, and the fresh oregano gives you a different experience and a different flavor and adds intrigue to the dish.
Mm. Yeah. I want it again. I want to have that more.
Yeah.
The way you described it, I was expecting it to be like spaghetti with tomato chunks and just kind of toss that way and to have like a very light, like, you know, white wine and olive oil, like type of like minimal sauce coating. I guess because the tomatoes like sweat down so much that it ends up being this like gorgeous kind of like very thin orangey sauce that just coats everything. And
yeah.
You
take the skin off of the tomato and then it just sort of like it breaks down a little bit, and then you toss the pasta enough that, yeah, it becomes its own sauce.
And how does one Do we peel the skins off of tomatoes? How do tomato skins
come off? So the easiest way to do it is to, like, if you have a gas range, you can just place the tomato, like, over the flame very briefly after you've, like, given it a little scoring.
You're like, you score it, okay.
And then it'll come right off. Oh. Or if you have, like, a little like, butane torch, if you don't have a gas range, you can do it that way. But just expose it to a little bit of heat and you can peel it right off.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the skin then doesn't become, like, a thing that gets stuck in your teeth or become a textural element or whatever. It's just the tomato flavor.
Yeah, no, I know why you don't want the tomato skins in there.
You were asking how.
How?
I garlic, tomato, oregano, parm, butter, fucking dope.
But you know what else is good?
What's that?
More, please.
He's waving his glass at me. More, as if please. To say, hey, wine boy, give me wine.
More, please.
He wants more wine.
We're going to go through my chart here while Jamie is slowly and reluctantly topping off my glass. We would say medium body. Medium body, yeah?
I think so, yeah.
No tannic compounds, phenolic compounds.
Well, you did say bitterness.
Tannin is a textural thing, not a flavor thing. Bitterness is flavor, not texture. It is,
yes, but that bitterness is produced by the same compounds.
Son of a bitch.
I know. It's annoying. It is what it is.
Very mild bitterness.
Yeah.
Like the mildest version of, like, the bitterness from, like, dark chocolate.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe that's the thing. Something about it is reminding me of, like, dark chocolate. And I think it's just the bitterness. Although there's something on the nose that's kind of getting me in the ballpark of, like, a 90% cacao bar, you know?
There's about 45% Grenache in this wine. And most other wine people who I talk to about this particular thing don't necessarily agree with me. But I think there's a very characteristic bitterness to Grenache, the variety specifically. And I think it comes through in this wine, and I think it does also come through on the nose. And I think you're hitting the nail on the head with, like, a cacao thing, or maybe sometimes it presents as, like, a coffee note. And I think it's very present here.
On the, on mouth, mouth
on,
says.
On mouth.
On mouth. A little underripe strawberries, maybe.
Uh-huh.
There's a sharpness. Yeah, I guess that's the acid. There's a, not a bite, but it's crisp. Like 10% laser beams, not super duper laser beams, but yeah,
like a medium plus acid.
Yeah. Like a crisp apple. Very floral, not on the nose, but on mouth. Mouth says floral. Does that make sense?
It does. It makes perfect sense. Yeah. But our new nomenclature of on mouth.
On mouth. Very distressing for most people to hear.
Yes.
And some kind of tropical thing on nose as well, like a pineapple or maybe a star fruit.
I was about to say star fruit. Yeah,
I like it. It's very refreshing. You should pick more rosés. We've never done a rosé on the show before.
Shut the fuck up.
I really enjoy this rosé.
You rat bastard.
No, I'm kidding. We've done 16 rosés on the show.
That
so far.
Also is not true. We have not done 16 rosés.
Off the top of your head, 3, 2, 1, go. How many rosés have we done?
Four. I think four.
I don't think that's true. What about that 6-part miniseries that we did that was just rosé, rosé, rosé?
That didn't happen, although it may at some point.
I would listen. I hate myself, but I would listen.
6 different rosés. That would be a good one for the winter. I like that.
Is winter rosé season?
Winter's not typically seen as rosé season, but I think one should consume rosé all year round.
Is this because you're an iconoclast?
No, it's because it's had enough time in the fucking bottle to, like, calm down and actually express itself. One of the problems that I have with this wine is that I've tasted older Ode to Lulu, and I know it to be even more vibrant and expressive and deep and layered and complex.
Right. I've heard this soapbox from you before, that you scold people, don't drink your 2021 rosés right away. Let them age a little bit because they
exactly
get better.
Right. Yeah. And, like, I'm glad that we're drinking this, like, 3 or 4 months after release, as opposed to right on release. But the 21 next year will be really, really stunning. I've got 18, 19, and 20 of this wine in my cellar. And I'm excited to dive into them because, like, each, they get better.
So what would this have tasted like if we had like it was first out of the case, like fresh off the bottling line, and we didn't wait a few months to have it? What would be the difference?
Kind of like volume turned down on everything, just muted, understated. It would still be delicious because it's a delicious wine, but like it needs time to unfurl. It needs time to express itself. It needs time in the bottle to sit there and think about what it's done.
But this isn't, but not decant, because you described in your pairing words needs time to age and or decant. So didn't decant this.
Rosé? You would know. You may have noticed that when I was pouring, I poured pretty aggressively to allow for more air into the wine.
I do not notice.
I know you don't.
Well, it's because I don't pay attention to you when you're pouring the wine.
You don't pay attention to me most times.
I pay attention to you all the time. But when you're refilling my wine, you're the help and you become invisible and I don't have to pay attention to you. No, that's mean.
That's mean.
That wasn't
hurtful
nice.
And not nice to other members of the service.
This is not about them. This is just about you.
I'm the only one that becomes the help and becomes invisible.
Well, like my child frequently tells me, you're the butler. Okay. When you go to pour me wine, you're just the butler. You're my servant.
And to be clear, your child tells you that you're the butler.
That's correct. Yeah.
He calls me the wine king.
That's right. Yeah. He has decided that he likes showers recently.
Nice.
But only if we pretend, his mother or I pretend that we are his butlers and like we reach in and like put the shampoo in his hair and then massage his scalp and then we have his towel or his robe there waiting for him to step out.
That is adorable.
I don't know where he got that idea, is something that butlers do.
Sometimes kids are creative and they just come up with these things.
He's very clever about putting me in a, you know,
in a service role. Yeah,
subservient position to him. Anyway, you're not my butler.
No, I'm not your butler.
So that's why you poured the wine aggressively.
Yeah, to get a little air. And that decanting is a way to mitigate those effects. You know, even if we had gotten this 4 months ago or whatever, I would have, you know, insisted that there be a decanter in here just so that we could, you know, taste a little bit more. And that's really what I'm looking for out of this. I really like this wine the way it is right now, but I know that a couple of months from now, a couple of months from then, it will continue to develop more things. And I don't know what happens when this wine crosses the line from like from a youthful wine to a developing wine, like when it develops its secondary flavors. I haven't tasted old Ode to Lulu, but my expectation is that it'll become something else that will also be extremely beautiful, because this wine is modeled after a very, very famous wine from France, which is why it's called Ode to Lulu.
And that wine is Lulu?
No, Lulu is a woman, or was. She regrettably passed away in 2017. No, 2020, my bad. She was the proprietor of Domaine Tompier in Bandol in France. And Bandol is the most famous region for growing Mourvèd, which is the 55% part of this wine.
So it's 55 Mourvèd and
45.
Hang on.
45.
Yes, I concur. 45 Grenache.
That's correct.
And both of those are grapes. Mourvèd, you have never mentioned before. Are we certain this is a grape?
This is a grape.
This isn't like a cherry varietal or something.
No, Mourvèd is a grape. So Lulu was, at the time of her passing, 102 years old. She was like famously very welcoming and convivial kind of lady who would welcome anyone into their estate and, you know, have dinner and drink a bunch of wine. And the rosé of Domaine Tompier was her brainchild. Her and her husband helped popularize Bandol in general over the course of the 20th century. And Bandol Rosé, as a result of Domaine Tompier, is recognized as one of the rosé styles that is expected to age well. And so Morgan Twain Peterson and Chris Cottrell, who are the guys that own Bedrock Wine Company, decided to make this wine in honor of her because they were able to source old vine Mourvèd and Grenache that they thought was suitable for this beautiful rosé.
Those two grapes, only one of which I've heard of before. But I take it on faith that they are both real grapes.
Yes.
And not just like random phonemes that you just strung together thinking you could trick me.
I should do that one of these times.
I will believe it, except that I'm inherently skeptical of all things. Speaking of which, we have to come back to something later on about my skepticism about you not knowing things.
Sure.
Try to remember that. This is very important.
Definitely will not remember. Why don't we just do it now?
And then I'll re-edit it later on?
Sure.
All right, but we have to come back to the grapes.
Uh-huh.
The two grapes.
The two grapes. Grenache, Mourvèdre.
Mourvèdre. Are they both white grapes?
They are both red grapes.
They're both red grapes.
Uh-huh.
Traditional semi-regular segment on the show, Johnny Words in memoriam.
Rest in peace.
His favorite thing I ever did on the show was, as an audience advocate, ask you to explain things you have explained before.
Uh-huh.
How does a red grape become a pink wine?
I have described several methods for making rosé. You can do the Seigneur method, which is by bleeding excess juice off of a red wine in progress, which concentrates the red wine and makes it darker, and then as a byproduct makes rosé. You can blend red and white wine together, which is very uncommon. The only place that it's relatively common is champagne. And then there's the maceration method where it's...
You got to get them skins off.
Get the skins there, but for a shorter period of time than you would for a red wine. This one is a direct press.
So this is a fourth method.
You could call it maceration. It's a direct press wine. Because Mourvèdre is so deeply colored, you can't get clear white juice, even if you do direct press. So they just direct press everything and you get this pale rosé.
And this concludes Johnny Words in memoriam. Rest in power, J Words.
I was about to say rest in power.
Yeah, I know you were. So Johnny Words is dead in memoriam. Oh yeah. Do you have things to say about the wine now? Do you have other things?
I said some things about the wine, but like one of the words that I used to describe this wine was an homage. I kind of wish that I was able to get us a bottle of the Tampier Rosé to compare, but it's a pretty rare wine. It's also expensive.
How expensive?
It's like $55-$60 a bottle.
That's too much. Too much for an homage, Jamie. Too much for an homage.
Whatever. It's a good wine. It's definitely, you know, if you're trying to engage with wine on an intellectual level, it makes sense to taste these two side by side.
Sure.
It would have been nice. Didn't happen. Maybe at some point you and I will enjoy a bottle of Tampier Rosé together. If I remember, which I definitely won't, because I don't remember anything because I have a bad brain.
Uh-huh.
I think that Bedrock has come up on this podcast before. We haven't done a Bedrock wine.
I have heard you say Bedrock a lot. You talk about Bedrock. I know you like these guys.
And I've brought a number of the bottles over here because a third of my cellar at home is Bedrock wine.
Jamie, is this fucking... This better be like a paid plug for Bedrock now.
It's not. I just really like their wines. And I've been taken by the wines for most of my wine career. They've been on and off of lists that I've worked. I really like Bedrock, okay?
Yeah.
It's good.
I don't dispute it. It's very tasty.
The guys that make it, Morgan Twain Peterson is the kind... Like, he's just so geeky and passionate about wine and about preserving old vines and making sure that historic vineyards don't get ripped out. And his business partner, Chris Cottrell, is this like, you know, jolly guy from New York who just jives really well with Morgan's vibe and has been able to help popularize the brand. And as a person who loves Zinfandel the way that I do, this is a house that focuses on it and does it really, really well. So they sort of hit all of my buttons. Including, you know, responsible regenerative agriculture and everything from their basic old vine Zinfandel all the way to their like massive line of single vineyard wines, I find to be really, really compelling. Even if there are some wines that I don't love, and there are a couple of their single vineyards that like are not my favorite because they're either, you know, too big, too alcoholic, too whatever, but I always find their wines to say something about the place that they come from and about the people who made them.
What does this say about the place that it comes from and or the people who made it?
Well, it says, I think I'm less prepared to talk about the place when it comes to this wine, because it's a California Appellation wine as opposed to a single vineyard Appellation. Like the vines, the grapes that go into this wine come from all up and down the North Coast of California.
Mm.
So it says that there's lushness, ripeness, concentration here. But what it says about the winemakers is that they're thoughtful is that they're paying attention to the past of wine and looking forward into the future. They're trying to make something that lasts a long time. And I, every year, you know, buy a little bit of this rosé and keep a little bit of it to age, along with obviously like just a ton of other bedrock wines.
All right, Jamie, pop quiz, hot shot.
Yeah.
Place this in the canon of rosés that we have discussed on the show so far. Briefly, as quickly as possible. All right, ready? We're going to go through it.
Oh, do you have the outline up?
I have the spreadsheet here. Okay. So compare it to, it can't possibly be true. The Maison Noir could not have been the first rosé that we did on the show.
Oh, it definitely was.
All right, fine. Compare it to the Maison Noir Love Drunk Rosé that we did with The Irishman.
Maison Noir Love Drunk Rosé should probably ideally be drunk within the first year of its release. It is bright, easy, like a simple experience, but something that is meant to be shared over conversation. Can be good with food, but is more of a cocktail wine. This is a serious, like, think about it type rosé that I think will age for a long time.
All right. What about?
Yeah, dude, for all your complaining, we've done two rosés on this show. The Fabrice Gasnier La Craventine, that was a sparkling rosé.
All right, so a sparkling rosé. Compare it to the Fabrice Gasnier.
The Fabrice Gasnier is all about acid and minerality. It's sharp. It's a little bit harsh. It, as we said in that episode, raises the anxiety level with a movie that can make you quite anxious. This is more broad and complex.
All right. Didn't you pick a rosé to go with our top five Marvel episode?
Top five Marvel. Maybe.
Aha. Mister, I only picked two rosés.
Also, the Cachique Maravilla Pet Nat Rosé with the first Best Picture noms.
Uh-huh. So let's do that one.
I mean, that is just like funk nasty. Like, it's party juice. It's silly wine.
And chunkissy.
And with chungus.
Yeah. And what about the one you did with the Marvel? What was that?
Etna Rosato from Tenuta della Terranera. That's the one that I would... That's the closest spiritually to this, because they're both built to age, although I would say that this is built with more intensity and power, and the Etna Rosato is built with more elegance.
And what about with Matrix Resurrections? You picked a Rosé Grigio, didn't you?
It wasn't a rosé. It was Ramato. It had a copper hue to it. There are Pinot Gris rosés.
That doesn't count as rosé?
No. It's a different style.
All right.
Anyway, it's bedrock.
And none of the children movies were rosés?
No.
Are you sure?
Oh, that was the one. Yeah, sorry. The Finca Torre Milanos, Ribera did.
Yet another rosé.
Yeah, which you hated, which was an insane take.
Mister, I only picked two rosés for this show. What are we up to now? Five?
Four.
Six?
Sure, five.
Yeah.
Five rosés out of 56 episodes.
It is not 56. This is episode 54. Two of those episodes were reruns. Anyway, so how does it compare with the Finca Torre Milanos, which I didn't like for reasons that I don't remember?
For insane reasons. That wine is fucking delicious.
Okay.
And you're just a crazy person.
And how does that wine compare to this one is the question.
This wine, that wine has the power and broadness that this one has, but it is more like rough around the edges, rustic. And I think that's the thing that you didn't love about it. It was like a little bit yeasty, maybe a little bit too earthy.
I didn't like the yeastiness or the rough around the edges rusticity.
And I don't know why you're complaining about rosé, because most of these rosés you've loved.
I'm not complaining.
I'm just complained.
I'm just calling you out when you say that I'm exaggerating the number of rosés that you picked.
You do exaggerate.
You just said that you've only picked two and that I have just shown you that you've picked five. So you are under-exaggerating.
Both of us are unreliable narrators.
That is fair. Anyway, this is good, and I like it, but I shouldn't have any more because now it's my time to talk more than you.
Yeah. I'm glad you liked it. I mean, we've drunk a lot of bedrock together just because, like, me coming over for dinner a bunch.
I can only take your word for that.
Your wife would recognize the label, and I'm sure she did.
I believe she did. Yeah.
It's a distinctive label. It's got this beautiful old vine with some buds coming out of it. It's gorgeous.
Let's move on.
Yes, let's talk about this fucking insane, weird-ass movie.
It's not that insane and
it's
weird-ass.
It's a little insane. I mean, it ends, spoilers, with someone sewed into...
Hey, give them a better spoiler warning. We'll do the legwork.
Everyone already knows that there are spoilers.
No, they don't, because we're not putting that in the copy anymore.
We're talking about the fucking movie.
We'll set the table, and then we'll give them the spoiler warning. And then you can talk about the ending. And you can tell them how you didn't find it funny and that most of them will not agree that it's funny. So we are talking about Midsommar. This is the second Florence Pugh movie that we're talking about today.
Actually, yeah, second that we're talking about today and third in total,
That's right, yeah. So Midsommar, Florence Pugh, star of Little Women that we have gushed over previously. Florence Pugh plays Dani, a young woman who is grieving a terrible and tragic and deeply terrible family loss. Content warning for both the movie, by the way, and for this discussion, but we will discuss plot points in the movie which relate to suicide. Hoping to distract herself from her grief, Dani tags along with her douchebag boyfriend Christian, played by Jack Raynor, and his anthropology student bro friends on a vacation to a remote Swedish village for a solstice celebration. And what follows is a slow burn, daytime, psychological folk horror nightmare. As Dani and company witness the community's disturbing rituals and become increasingly paranoid, all while Dani slowly comes to realize that Christian is a piece of shit and she should get out of this relationship while the getting's still good. Midsommar is written and directed by Ari Aster. It is his follow-up feature to 2018's Hereditary. Have you seen Hereditary?
No. I don't even know what it is.
Oh, man. Oh, boy. Toni Collette in like a...
I like Toni Collette.
Witch horror movie?
Sure.
But like, you don't really know what it is until it is what it is, and then the audience is losing their mind by the end of the movie.
Great.
I think I saw like the second public screening of it ever at the first Overlook Festival that was in New Orleans, and I think it had just played either South by or Sundance at that point and nowhere else, and so none of us really knew what to expect. And there is a bit towards the end of the movie, after shit has started to get real, where the horror and the danger has really come to the fore, and there's like this low angle close up on like our hero character who is in danger from a thing that he doesn't know what he's in danger of. And in the background of a shot, something terrible and gruesome is happening in the shadows in like the top corner of the screen. And it's not like there's like a jump scare, like from music cue to like let you know that something just popped up. You just have to spot it. And you could like hear smatterings throughout the audience, throughout this long shot, as people figured out what the thing was and started like screaming and then laughing as like other sections of the audience spotted it. And it was very distressing.
Okay.
Yeah. But like this movie with Hereditary, the most distressing parts are like the fucked up interpersonal dynamics. Anyway, long digression. Midsommar was like a modest hit in the summer of 2019. It did pretty good, like at my little independent theater where we booked it, and it played to gangbusters crowds for the first 2 weekends. It garnered mostly positive reviews and critics and was much more divisive with audiences because that's just how A24 rolls with their horror movies. They pick up the, or like they help finance these, you know, weird, quote unquote, elevated horror movies, these like art house boutique-y horror artsy films, and then they market them like regular horror movies, and then audiences get real mad on opening weekend, and the cinema score ratings are usually pretty fucking toxic. But yeah, what'd you think, Jamie? Were you down with this, or were you like the people who saw, for example, another A24 horror movie with me opening night in I was in New York for whatever reason, and we caught like a 10:30 opening night show of The Witch. Robert Eggers's first feature, The Witch, and the audience was not happy when that movie ended. And Tani and I thought it was amazing.
I think I'm somewhere in the middle on this one. Not that I have strong feelings about this movie.
No one doesn't. You can't walk away with this without strong feelings.
Yeah.
No one's ambivalent about Midsommar.
my big thing turning this movie off was I don't know if I enjoyed what just happened.
That's fair.
And I still don't know.
It is stressful and unpleasant and difficult.
Yes.
Did you not think it was funny at all?
The only laugh that I got was the spoiler that I was about to...
Spoilers, if you have not seen Midsommar, you should go and watch it. Check it out. It's very good, potentially great.
Yeah, whether you like it or not, it is worth a watch.
Yeah. But so, the spoiler warning has been thrown down. There shall be no further warnings.
The one bit that I found to be funny...
is when Christian is sewed up inside a bear.
That's right.
Which is incredible.
When he's sewn up inside a bear and it's lit on fire.
So funny. So incredibly funny.
There's so much distressing imagery in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the one that hit me as funny. The rest of it hit me as horrific.
No, I don't find the distressing imagery funny. Like, I don't find the elders who take a nosedive off the cliff and have their brains split open on a rock below. That's not funny to me. The violence, except for Christian being sewn up inside a bear suit and then set on fire. The violence is not funny to me. I laugh at her douchebag friends the entire time. I laugh at Christian and at Josh, who to me is just like shitty cheaty from The Good Place. And what's his name? The one played by Will Poulter, the one who like really objectively sucks.
Yeah. He's the one that dies right after the first two. The couple that like immediately want to leave.
Well, he's the one who just disappears for a while. He's right. The guy who sucks.
And he ends up with his lungs inverted.
No. The one with the lungs inverted is the guy from the couple who wants to bolt right away.
Oh, is that right?
He's the one, yeah, whose lungs are outside of his body and he's somehow still breathing. So gnarly.
Very distressing.
Yeah. No, Will Poulter is the other friend. Okay. The white guy friend who sucks.
I forget his name.
Yeah, he just sucks.
They all have generic white people names.
But like, Jamie, come on. Like, they first get to the Swedish solstice village and like they're talking with the father or whatever and the elder, and the Will Poulter character just like takes a huge hit off his vape and just spits like a huge amount of smoke. He is douchiness and they're like general shitty American bro indifference is funny to me. Not funny in that like they are funny characters, but that in the same way that like a horror movie, like a horror movie, what you think of as like a slasher movie or something, will present you with a series of shitty characters, like bad people. And you can always tell who's going to get killed off first because it's like the shittiest, douchiest person.
I guess. Yeah. I didn't think they were caricature-ish though.
I'm not saying they're caricatures, but that you can see how shitty they are. And if you're paying attention to what the movie is, it's like, oh, I can't wait for this guy to die a terrible death on or off screen.
I guess. I didn't get that. I didn't get that contemptibility. I think partly because the first thing that we see from Christian's friends are them giving him the objectively correct advice, which is to get out of the relationship that he's in.
Wow. All right. Okay. Interesting. Not the angle I thought you were going to take, because Christian sucks.
Oh, he sucks. He 100%
sucks.
He sucks. But their relationship is bad. And it's not 100% his fault either.
Here's the thing about that. We do not know that their relationship is bad. Because the only time we ever see them together is after the horrible tragedy happens.
What we know about their relationship is that she is insecure about it. She feels like she's driving him away. And then those sentiments are echoed immediately by him and his friends that she is, in fact, driving him away. And so they should not be together.
Right.
Like, but whether or not he's a shit, whether or not he sucks, the two of them should not be together. And his friends are right that he should break up with her.
Right. But the thing that his friends are leaving out is that the reason she is so insecure is because he's a fucking shitty boyfriend who at every turn will neg her, will lie to her, will act passive aggressively, will be defensive, and will ultimately try to prey on her willingness to be a people pleaser. And he will prey on her insecurity to make her feel worse and to get away with shit.
That's what we find out through the rest of the film.
Right.
But right at the beginning there, we're set up with a 1-2 punch of this is a bad relationship and here are several people telling you to get out of it.
Right. But they're not correct. It's not like they're saying, hey, Christian, you obviously don't want to be in this relationship and you're a shitty boyfriend. They're saying, hey, dude, you should get out of this relationship because she sucks and she needs a therapist. Like, no, they are not correct. As we learn over, because the movie in the beginning is like, and this is something that like apparently the director's cut really makes more explicit. That like what a douchebag Christian is, which I don't necessarily need. Like, I feel like in the beginning, they show
more of that.
No, he's the worst from square one. They go to this fucking party, which is some undetermined amount of time after her sister has killed herself and murdered their parents. And she goes along with him to the party. And that's where Danny finds out that he's actually going to Sweden and that he's been planning it.
Right.
And then they come back to the apartment and she rightfully calls him out. Like, you've obviously been planning this and you never told me. And he draws a line and he gets defensive and acts like it's her fault.
And then she apologizes.
Yes. And that's his MO the whole time, which means that's been his MO the entire relationship. That's just what kind of guy he is. And it's not just the way that he interacts with her. Because after the old people sacrifice and he tells fucking Chidi, Josh, that he, you know what, I think I'm going to do my dissertation on Midsummer here.
Oh my God, yeah.
And he plays the exact same card he's the problem. He's the worst. He's a douchebag and he deserves to get sewn up inside a bear costume and set on fire.
I mean, I don't know that maybe that offense really requires that punishment. I don't know that that's exactly right.
All right.
And I'm with you.
Are we talking 100% about the world or are we talking about a movie? Because I'm talking about a movie, and in the morality of the movie, he deserves to get set on fire inside a bear.
Sure. Fine. I'll give you that. My point earlier was that in the beginning, we're not given quite enough information. We don't get anything on their relationship until he's delayed breaking up with her so long that now her parents are dead and he feels like he can't. And I'm not saying that's an excuse to treat her shitty. Because it absolutely isn't, and he should be a better human, and he fucking is awful.
And should be sewn up inside a bear costume and set on fire.
Sure.
I should be clear, it's not a bear costume.
It's a bear.
It is a recently alive bear.
It is a recently alive, disemboweled bear.
And they just put him inside. The look on his face when he just like wakes up inside a cutout bear's head.
Isn't he awake the whole time? It's like he's paralyzed. Maybe it's just a...
When like the ripped open bear maw with like little bits of like meat and
gets put on him and he's like looking around. The only muscles that he can move are his eye muscles.
So good. It's so good.
His performance was really good with just his eyes.
I really like Jack Rayner. I've liked him in a couple of things. He's great in this little Irish movie called Sing Street. Fantastic. Like coming of age, like teenagers make a, you know, garage rock band. Fucking awesome coming of age movie. But he plays like the sage older brother, and he's so good in that movie. And he's just such a spectacular douchebag in this.
Anyway, it took me longer to come around to like everyone being quite so shitty, because it felt like at the beginning they were giving him what on face is pretty reasonable advice. Like, this is a bad relationship and you should leave.
Yeah, it's hard to agree with their advice because they all suck so much.
Right.
And their point of view is you should get out of this relationship so that we can go like, you know, fuck some Swedish girls on our solstice vacation.
And that,
which is absolutely what he was going to do.
Oh,
if 100%. Danny did not come with them.
Well, it isn't. He was, no matter what happened, he was going to get sewn inside of a bear.
But he probably wouldn't have waited until he was drugged to the point of borderline incapacitation to start nailing Swedish village girls.
That's correct, yes. Yeah. This movie's so bizarre.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It is a sensory overload also.
The drug trip sequences are so good.
They're really, really good.
And I love
her running through the forest, like trying to get away. Oh, my God.
Trying to get away from her panic attack.
Yep.
Because she's amazing.
She's great.
She really elevates what is a very problematic character. Like the relationship is, before this episode, I reread a few reviews, including Manola Dargis's great review in the New York Times of the movie. And she was one of the outliers on like not being on board the Midsummer train. And one of her beefs with the movie, which I don't disagree with, is that the relationship really falls into pretty trite, like, gender dynamics, where, like, she's the needy woman and he's the dude trying to shrug her off, which, like, I do think is kind of the point, but it doesn't mean that the characterizations are super rich.
Right.
And I think on the page, the characterizations are pretty thin, but Florence Pugh in particular just elevates that. And she invests it in with so much, like, pain and humanity and depth and integrity. Like, she's just so... It's the same thing with Black Widow. The character in Black Widow, not all that great. But Florence Pugh, like, you know, the singer is outdistancing the song, is what I'm saying.
I think it's kind of an unfair criticism to say that it's just that, you know, needy woman dynamic. We're talking about a character whose family just died.
For sure.
Right? Like, it's not... She's not necessarily a needy person.
Mm-hmm.
She has one person left in her life who is ostensibly family, mm-hmm. and it's him.
Yeah. Let's say the movie starts with them in Sweden. Let's say we take the first 20 minutes of it off, right?
Mm-hmm.
Removing the context for the way the character behaves.
Sure.
Does the character still behave the way that Manola Dhar just described it?
Yes.
So she's talking about behavior, not necessarily... context or motivation. Like, you can have an interesting and a compelling and a justifiable motivation, but is that characterized or dramatized in any way that isn't just needy woman who is, like, codependent with her boyfriend? I think it's a fair knock on the movie. I think the characters are kind of weak, but the aesthetic and the vibe and the looming dread and the experience of it and the performances are so good that, like, I can overlook that, if not forgive it.
I could get with that. I don't know that I think the context is very important, and I don't know what else you're going to do with that character other than she becomes a needy person because, or, like, she behaves needy because her fucking family just died.
Yeah.
And she's trying to cling to the one person that she thinks is there for her.
Yeah. I mean, something
you could be there for her.
Something you could do with it is not wait 2.5 hours for her to break that cycle.
Right.
Like, what if she...
Right, but what person who's ever experienced grief has ever done that? What person who has ever lost their family has then taken that moment to cut any other emotional tie? Like, that just seems very out there and beyond the experience of most people.
Yeah.
Yes, you could do that, but that's kind of contrary to what we know about how people respond to grief.
But she does it. She does it in the movie. And I'm just saying, you're asking what else could one do with it? And I'm saying that the breaking point of her cutting those ties doesn't need to be the end of the movie. That could be the midway point of the movie, and then we deal with the ramifications of it.
Sure.
Instead of just spending 2.5 hours of her getting to the point where she decides, you know what?
Yeah.
Fuck this guy. I choose that he should be set on fire while alive and sewed inside a dead bear.
And then you have and after that, where she, like, gets married to Pele.
Maybe. Yeah, I guess.
Covered in flowers.
And she smiles. That horrifying smile she gives in, like, the crossfade. God, it's so good. The ending is so good.
And she is at that point just a mound of flowers.
I think it was something like 10 to 20,000 silk flowers made up that dress that was, like, later sold at auction. Incredible bit of wardrobe that, like, instantly became iconic.
Do we call that a dress? It goes over her whole everything.
I guess it's a bush that that's inside of.
That's kind of
It's wardrobe, though. Like, it's wardrobe for the actor. Like, it's something she had to wear.
It blurs the line between wardrobe and set.
Or shrubbery. Yeah. I really like this movie. My wife was not pleased with me because, as I had described it in our previous episode setting up this discussion, and as I have described it since I saw the movie, I think it is darkly comedic. I think it's funny. Not ha-ha funny, but, like, I saw it.
Okay, talk to me about the parts that you think are funny.
I saw it opening night, and I was not alone in a sold-out crowd of people who were laughing uncomfortably throughout the movie. Not uproariously, not frequently.
But uncomfortably.
But occasionally laughing. And as I said, I'm mostly laughing at, not with, but at the dudes. Laughing at Christian, laughing at his bros, laughing at how shitty they are, laughing at how much they suck as typical American bro tourists. It's very cheap and very easy, but if you want to make a character look like an asshole, you have them standing in a group of people and one of them is talking and your other character starts vaping. And the bigger the vape cloud, the bigger the asshole they are. That is funny to me. Or like the scene right before they leave where Christian is like, oh, by the way, guys, Danny is coming over and I invited her to come with us to Sweden, but she's not going to come. But I did invite her because, you know, all the things with her family.
But it was your suggestion.
But you guys suggested it and you're all totally cool with it. And they're like, and then she comes in and they're like, so Sweden, huh? And she's like, yeah, I think I'm going to come. And then Will Poulter character is like, oh, hey, Christian, can you look at my dissertation with me in the other bedroom? Like the dumb college bro version of like a stereotypical like woman in a restaurant scene. Like, can you come with me to the powder room for a moment? Right. Like, thinking he's getting away with it, their stupidity is hilarious to me. And their shittiness and the way that they isolate her and make her feel terrible is awful. But the shittiness and how obvious and transparent it is funny to me, knowing that they are in a horror movie, knowing that they are going to be dispatched in a horrible fashion, and then seeing the weird Baroque ways that they are dispatched and dismembered.
Baroque is a really good way to put
it. It's not hilarious, but it is darkly comic. It is darkly, weirdly funny. The fact that when Christian eats his meat pie and pulls a hair out of his mouth and they all immediately clock that it's a pube. Yo, dude, that's a pube. And then later on, after Danny is tripping balls and she's been chosen as the May Queen and the village elder woman takes Christian aside and she's like, I believe Maya has feelings for you and we've chosen you to be able to mate with her. And he's like, oh, yes.
I think I ate her pube.
I think I ate one of her pubes.
And the woman is like, that seems likely or some such.
I find all of that weirdly, awkwardly funny. After they've drugged him, or he has allowed himself to be drugged, because at any point, any of them could have said, I'm not going to have your unnamed hallucinogens. But he takes the drugs and has a bad trip and goes in. He has sex with Maya and all of the other nude women are there chanting. And then they're empathetically experiencing her pleasure while the two of them are having sex. And then they're like helping him thrust into her.
Yep.
And then he runs out. Dick flapping in the wind and then just like runs around the compound, like pathetically covering up his genitals with his hands. That's all hilarious to me. That's so funny. And it doesn't undercut the stuff that is real. Because the counterpoint to that scene is Danny seeing him or at least overhearing him fucking Maya.
Right.
And Danny goes and has a complete panic attack and all the other May Queen candidates come with her and they all have a panic attack together. And they're all screaming in unison. And that's so fucking powerful and such a beautiful and bizarre scene. And it is not in any way undercut by the stuff that I find is funny. I love how those things can sit together. We're talking about Thor Ragnarok. Like the humor in this movie does not undercut the real drama and the pathos.
For sure.
They sit awkwardly but organically together.
I think I missed a bit of the funny.
That's fine.
I mean, as you say, it's a little subtle. It's a little...
It's one of those things about seeing a thing with a movie or seeing a movie with an audience is an audience will sometimes help you know, they'll help you trust your instinct about, is this funny? Oh, okay. Somebody else finds this funny. Maybe I'm not a monster.
You or told
maybe
me I'm it was not darkly alone. Funny. And I was I was looking for it. I didn't quite, I don't know. I was distressed by a lot of it. I was,
it's distressing.
And the visuals are so incredibly striking. And the sense of daylight is always there is a whole like other bit of psychological stress.
Isn't that incredible to do a horror movie in broad daylight the entire time?
Yep.
And like what a challenge as a filmmaker, because Ari Aster in Hereditary like uses darkness and shadow to create suspense in the way that like horror filmmakers have been since the beginning of narrative film. You know, like what you can't see, what's hidden in the darkness can be terrifying and that creates suspense. And then the challenge for his second feature, like he had made a bunch of shorts before, but like to challenge himself and say, I'm going to make something that's horrifying, not terrifying, but it is horrifying.
It is horrifying.
And it's never about darkness and shadow and scaring you and surprising you. It's always about dread and unease and feeling trapped in these huge open spaces. And
the feeling of being trapped is so palpable. There is nothing around for hundreds of miles. You're fully dependent on these people for everything. You're in this like communal sleeping environment, and basically everyone who's a part of the community, their default disposition to you, if you are even a little bit upset, is to like placate you in the most superficial possible way. I found that to be uniquely uncomfortable.
Well, and also like watching a bunch of people who, and like, it, this is where like the experience of all of them is a mirror and an extrapolation of Danny's experience in the relationship. Danny knows that Christian sucks. Danny knows that he's not supportive of her and he's not there for her, and that he probably is going to cheat on her, and that he lies to her and manipulates her all the time. But she accepts his lies, right?
Right.
They all know when shit starts getting weird, they know when they're being placated. They know when they're being manipulated by the weird elders of the community.
Right.
They know that they are in danger and that something is wrong, and they all continually go along with it. Like, what is to stop any of them from just picking up their bags and walking back down the long road and just hitchhiking their way home? They all know that something is fucked and they just go along with it. They're not trapped by anything other than the expectations of not violating social contracts. They don't want to be rude. That is the only thing any of them are trapped by. They don't want to be rude.
And they die for it.
Yeah.
Everyone except for Danny.
Except for Danny, who gets to be the May Queen and sets Christian on fire. I genuinely, this is something I don't remember if this is something I actually witnessed or if it's something I saw on Twitter. So this is apocryphal, but I remember specifically after opening night hearing a couple say after the movie was over, it was a man and a woman who had seen the movie together, and credits start rolling. And again, this could be a thing I saw on Twitter or could be something that I personally witnessed, but the man leans over to her and's like, he doesn't deserve that. And the look she gives him, and it was clear that this conversation is what the rest of their night was going to be about.
That is, that's a bad take from that guy.
You just said you didn't think he deserved
in
it.
In the world, but like right as the everything comes down, like, yeah, that is cathartic to watch him burn like that.
Yeah.
In this movie.
It's cathartic to watch her him burn.
Well, to watch her, like, she's the one that chose it, yeah, right? She was given the choice.
Yeah.
Him or this other, like, villager guy.
Yeah.
Who's, like, gladly volunteering himself.
Yeah.
And she chooses him.
Fuck him. He sucks. I love it. I think the movie is a little troubled. I think it's a little overlong. And I think some of the characterization is a little thin. But the ending, the last half hour, like, once the May Queen sequence starts, is so thrilling and horrifying and uneasy and weirdly funny. And the last half hour to 45 minutes, I just find to be extraordinary. It's so singular.
When the elders kill themselves.
Ooh.
Well, when the one elder kills, kills herself, and then he just falls on his leg and has to have his head smashed.
I mean, it's bad enough when his like legs are squashed and his bones are sticking out. And then they come over with the big long hammer.
It's almost a cartoon hammer.
Like, but then his head breaks open like a cantaloupe and the squashing, and we keep seeing it and the wet sound. Oh God, it's so awful. And it's not short either.
No.
The scene goes on for quite a while.
And they don't like cut away from it.
Nope. They cut back to it repeatedly. It's so gross.
Okay.
That is one of the like rare bits of like physical violence that I will turn my eyes away from because it just lingers on a mashed face with like teeth sticking out. Oh.
Well, even just like the first one who falls, it lingers on that person's exploded head.
Yeah. Yeah, it's gnarled.
Like exploded on a rock. And you're like, "Oh my God, how could this get worse?" Oh, of course it gets worse when the second one doesn't die on impact.
Yeah, he doesn't do a dive. He just steps off.
And it's just his bottom half. And then the other people who get made into
like scarecrows essentially.
Yes. Yeah. What the fuck?
Yeah, the rituals are so bizarre and so gruesome. And then the two fucking guys from the community who volunteer to go into like the ceremonial sacrificial burning building and they're told that they won't feel any pain. And then suddenly, the guy's legs burst into flames and then he starts screaming. Like the way that we linger with them and like you empathize with them in a way, it's like it doesn't let the audience off the hook ever.
No. And I think also, and I thought about this while I was watching it, showing the fact that they were told that they wouldn't feel anything and then watching them feel everything is also a way of telling us that Christian is feeling everything, even though he's paralyzed.
Oh, yeah. Good. Fuck that guy. He sucks.
Yeah, he does. He sucks. Yeah. He's like the amalgamation of every bad boyfriend ever.
But he thinks he's a good guy.
He does. Well, which all is the bad most, boyfriends think that they're good guys.
But that's like the most insidious part about him.
Right. I'm one of the good ones.
Yeah, I'm one of the good ones.
I'm standing with her after her family died.
Oh, God. And then when they're going to take shrooms, they first get like the first stop on their trip to the Midsummer Village. And they're going to take shrooms. And she's like, nah, you know, I need to get settled because she's just had at least one panic attack on the plane on the way there.
Right.
Then she's the ellipsis of editing from like her freaking out in the airplane bathroom stall to her like in the car on the way there. She's probably had more than one panic attack along this journey. Or just like
a continual panic
attack. Yeah, or it's just been going on. And then they're going to take shrooms. And she's like, Christian, I want to wait to get settled. And he's like, oh, okay. Hey guys, don't worry. I'm gonna hold off. I'm gonna wait with Danny because I want us to like come up at the same time. It's like, no, that's not what you want, you son of a bitch. you're using the group to pressure her into doing it, but you're gonna try and get good boyfriend points.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what ends up happening.
Which is exactly what happens, because he knows her and he knows how to manipulate her, but he doesn't want to get shit. He forgets her birthday. And then thinks it's okay to just like give her like a bran muffin or something that was presented at the buffet with a candle in it. He's just the worst. Sew that motherfucker up inside a bear and set him on fire, Jamie. He deserves it. I want to hear you say it. I want you to recant from what you said a while ago. He deserves it.
He deserves it. You're right.
Put that motherfucker in a bear.
Well, I mean, the bear didn't deserve it.
It's true. The bear didn't deserve it. That's also very funny. That just like slow pan across and they're like, is that a bear? And the guy's like, yeah, it's a bear. Cool. Chekhov's bear just sitting there waiting for us all to find out what's going to happen.
That's right.
It's funny. I think it's funny.
Okay.
My wife disagrees. I think it's very funny.
I'm
going
to watch it again and I'll report back to everyone if I think it's funny on the second viewing.
Great. Excellent. Cool. Now, my question to you.
Yes.
Do you think it pairs well with this wine?
I don't know. I don't know either.
I think the floral notes
that exactly. You noted on the nose, the like florality. This is a very, there are flowers everywhere.
It's a very pastel movie as well. It's pastel, it's pastoral, it's floral.
So like, sure. And also the fact that this is kind of like a cheerful rosé that is like, you know, fruit forward helps with some of the like looming dread.
Mm-hmm. I think it works.
Yeah.
I had it with, I actually opened the bottle. When I watched the movie, I think it worked very nicely. I was reaching for it on a regular, healthy basis.
I mean, I do want a drink with this movie.
Yeah.
Whatever the drink is.
But I think this is a solid
pairing.
I think it's a solid pairing. I think it's a very good pairing, wine to the food. I think your wine selection to go with the spaghetti what now?
Spaghetti a la chitarra with heirloom tomatoes.
Yes. But I think the food and wine pairing is very good. And I think the movie and wine pairing at least is a bare minimum 6 out of 10, maybe even a 6.5 to 7 out of 10. If we were to come up with some kind of numerical metric,
mm-hmm.
I feel like they don't go poorly together and there's some crossover.
Yeah. I think there's good crossover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what about the words? Let's do it. Let's do the rhetorical part of it. Where are the words?
Needs time to decant and or age.
And that's just because the movie is long and it takes a while to get where it's going.
It sure does.
Yes. Homage. So the homage specifically is that this movie is like a big touchstone for it is the 1973, The Wicker Man, which is like also about like someone coming to like a weird rural isolated community with like pastoral aesthetics and there's ritual sacrifice and it's you know pagan and there's people getting set on fire.
Okay.
So like explicitly an homage to that film.
Sure.
Powerful. Is that like powerful? You said powerful for Rosé. This is powerful for a horror movie.
I agree.
This could be a cheap exploitative horror movie and it could be in and out in 85 minutes.
And it's not. It takes its time to wind up.
It revels, man. It really makes you live with the pain specifically of Danny. I relish in the pain of all of her bro friends, but you really anguish with her.
You do.
Yeah. Pale. The movie, just like aesthetically, it's all daylight. It's very like washed out at times. Pale. And defies expectations. Ain't nobody was going to tell you what was going to happen by the end of that movie.
No.
There was no predicting any of that.
Yeah, I mean, you start off with a murder-suicide, and then you to just, I don't even know how to describe, like, where you get at the end. Mm. But, like, ritual, sacrificial, murder... catharsis?
Well, that's the thing. It's not just that it's dark and weird. It's that the dark and the weird is a beautiful self-actualizing catharsis for her. And right. That we are, in a way, I cheer for her at the end of the movie. I'm like, yes, you did it. You cut off this fucking tie. You cut this dead weight relationship. And maybe he's suffering more than his shitty boyfriendly sins warrant. But you know what? This is good for you. And I'm here for you, Danny.
There is an argument that, like, now she's trapped in that community because they're for sure not going to let her go anywhere and tell anyone what she just witnessed.
And now she has a community who supports her and they are empathetic to her pain. And it's not just words, but that group of women, like, puts themselves in her place and feels her pain alongside of her. And she has a support system that she has never had prior.
Okay.
I don't know how trapped she is.
I mean, she's trapped. If she wanted to leave, they would likely not let her.
I don't know. She's the May Queen. I feel like she can write her own ticket now.
We hope. We hope that she has the choice. So, it's a fucking movie.
Mm.
This was a lot. We've discussed much of it, although there's definitely more that we could have said.
We barely touched on all the drug trips, but that's okay.
Yeah, that is okay. We don't need to go there.
Yeah. They eat a lot in this movie.
There are a lot of meal scenes.
A lot of shared meal scenes, a lot of very tense, uncomfortable meal scenes, a lot of imbibed hallucinogens meal scenes.
Yep. Mostly the meal scenes are like uncomfortable family meals.
Mm-hmm.
Or rather like, I don't know, the rest of the family is very comfortable, but they're all fish out of water and they don't know how to act.
While they're being stared at.
Right.
And vaguely threatened and also fed pubes. And it's like very menacing and like the awkward social graces of like, or like when they have to wait for the two old people to decide to eat first.
Yeah, I don't remember much about the food other than that the meat pie has a pube in it.
Well, and she helps make the meat pies. And I mean, even just like the first scene with the bro dudes, like they're at like a bar or a pizza place.
Yeah, that's true.
There's a lot of the movie that's about like community,
shared
and communal
food. Shared food.
That's all I'm saying. Also, I don't know, maybe they're gonna like, it's like bear ducking or something, and they're just, you know, gonna fish Christian out of there, and he's like wrapped in bear cracklings, and then that's gonna be a meal.
That's so gross.
Yeah,
I have said on this podcast before that culture is communicated through food.
Oh, they're telling us a lot.
They are. They're telling us a lot.
It's a tradition to feed the boy that you like pubes. And also, maybe we wrap that boy in bearskin so that he'll be extra savory and gamey after we barbecue him.
Okay. I'm sure that your wife has some takes.
She has.
Are there wife takes?
Well, I mean, she has traditional capital W, capital T, wife takes, the game.
Right.
The podcast game in which my wife, Tani, generously recreates her favorite way to gently antagonize Jamie the way that we used to do when we would go to restaurants where he would work and serve us wine, and he would bring us glasses of wine, which were almost always delicious. Sometimes they tasted like raisins and he was very panicked, and she pointed out to me that maybe recently in my descriptions of wife takes and the way that she would rib you at the restaurants, that I made it sound like she was meaner than she actually was. And she wasn't really mean.
No, she was engaging with me.
She was engaging with you, but also mocking you a little bit.
Right.
And the silly, pretentious ways that you and your some ilk florally and poetically describe wines.
Yes.
Well, this game started as her way of recreating that on a podcast, and now it's just like questions and comparing wine and food and movies, and it's always funsies. So, wife takes for today. She has Three questions.
All right, I'm ready.
One, which food does this movie ruin the most? A, Swedish meatballs. B, herring. C, individually sized meat pies. D, barbecue.
Ooh, I don't know that it ruins any of it.
I think it might be meat pies.
Those meat pies still looked good.
They did look very good, but they are the only foods that I did see someone pick a pube out of.
Still, I guess, ruined the most, sure, meat pies.
The Swedish meatballs are not in it.
I will 100% still go and eat a meat pie at some point, even if it's got pubes in it.
Her answer is technically no right answer, but actually all of the above, plus also strawberry lemonade. Oh, man, she's good. All right, question number two. Which aspect of this movie does this wine most resemble? A, alfresco lunch in a stark noonday sun. B, a liminal sense of motion from things that are otherwise unusually still. C, dark humor mined from generally unfunny situations.
It doesn't really resemble any of those things.
I don't think this wine resembles alfresco lunch in the noonday sun. Nor a liminal sense of motion, nor dark humor.
No.
No, she's just having fun.
Yeah. I mean, we'll say, for argument's sake, probably lunch in the noonday sun.
Well, her answer is, I'm going with A, alfresco lunch in the stark noonday sun.
Yeah.
Because the wine seems bright and companionable to me, but I'll accept B, a liminal sense of motion from things that are otherwise unusually still. C is wrong, however, because the movie ain't darkly funny. It's just dark and extremely stressful, and you're wrong. She's talking to me.
She's talking to you.
I'm wrong. Yeah, it's not funny. Well, you know.
Different strokes, different folks.
Question the third and final. Do you feel this wine pairs with creeping dread? And if not, what can you recommend as an antidote so that the listener might enjoy the rest of the summer without being deeply skeeved out by friends, family, flowers, food, and direct sunlight?
I don't know that I have an antidote for that particular condition.
Except for just excess of alcohol.
That was, yes.
There's not a specific alcohol.
Just all of it.
Just quantity.
Just drink a lot.
Okay.
You know, wake up, start drinking. And don't stop until you fall asleep.
These are Jamie's solutions to all of life's problems.
That's right.
Yes. Yeah. She was not pleased with me.
Next time, our fifth episode in this miniseries.
Fifth and penultimate episode of Jamie's Philadelphia Tasting Menu.
For the tasting menu, I contacted Judy Nee, a friend of mine and owner of Bowlogy, B-A-O, as in Bao Buns.
Ooh, I love Bao Buns.
L-O-G-Y, Bowlogy, a restaurant on Arch Street in Philadelphia. And she decided to devise a special, especially for us.
What?
For this show. Yeah, kind of wild.
What?
She got super excited. And started, you know, she was the last one to finally respond. And it was because she came up with something new.
That's awesome.
The food that she created for us is a curried crab Shenzhen bao with corn and jalapenos.
Shut up. That sounds amazing. And what is the name of it? Does it have a name?
Shenzhen bao is the specific like Taiwanese bao bun type that she's making. And it will have inside of it curried crab, corn, and jalapenos.
That sounds so good. I'm going to eat that.
Yep.
And be very excited that it is somehow in honor of this dumb show. What is her name again, your chef friend?
Judy.
Judy. Thank you so much, Judy. Jamie, give Judy, I don't know, a special shout out.
Fucking
DM her or something.
I will.
And tell her if she wants to, I don't know, have you pick a Marvel movie. She can leave a review for the show, and then you'll watch it, and we'll talk about it.
Judy also is just like a really, really special person. I'm, you know, happy to know her as I do. I'm a little mad that it took me as long as it did to finally meet her. You know, she's sort of led the charge for workers' rights in Philadelphia and has made sure that she pays all of her staff very, very appropriately. She's got very progressive policies at her restaurant, led the charge to feed hungry people in the industry during the pandemic. I just think the world of her. And she's also one of these people who kind of knows everyone, and she's made a lot of connections for me and other people that I know in the industry. So the wine that I chose to pair with it is Schramsberg Blanc de Blanc 2018. A sparkling wine made in the Champenois method.
The Champenois method, you say?
Which is available at Crush Wine Company for $32 plus tax and shipping.
Well, to pair with that wine, not with the bao buns, although I would be cautiously optimistic that it goes along with it, continuing our, you know, tenuous theme of the power of food and or a shared meal, we will be watching 2021's Pig. Jamie, have you watched Pig yet?
I have not.
Oh, man. So this is a movie directed by Michael Sarnowski. This was a little like sleeper hit last year. And it's Nicolas Cage like doing the work, not going like the full Cage, not like big and ridiculous and kabuki theater overacting that has become sort of the thing he's known for in the back half of his career. But he's doing like very small internal humanistic work. And I kind of don't want to talk about it too much, except to the premise is that Cage lives alone in the woods with a truffle pig. And he's a hermit and he has a truffle pig and they have this like beautiful bond together. And then the truffle pig goes missing and he goes after it. And it becomes this like dark night of the soul of him like going through the fine dining establishment, tasting all the dishes, trying to find out who's got his truffle pig.
Oh my God.
And it is a profound movie about like food and sense memory and family and loss and grief. And it's fucking gorgeous. And Cage is amazing in it.
I'm excited to watch it.
Yeah. Pig. Nicolas Cage, directed by Michael Sarnowski. It is, as of this episode's release, available for your streaming pleasure on the Who of Lou or wherever it is you get your VODs. And everybody should check it out because it's great. And it's only 91 minutes long.
We love a tight 91.
It is a full hour shorter than Midsummer.
So thank you, everyone.
I thought he was saying thank you to me. You never say thank you to me.
I thank you for other things.
Patently untrue. Wow,
don't lie to the people. The people deserve truth.
All right.
Thank you, audience, for joining us. Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us if you have questions, comments, concerns, or if you're an international viewer and listener, if you're an international listener and would like us to read your review on the air, and you can also make me watch a fucking Marvel movie at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends about our show, please.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me. And our social media presence is the fine work of Jamie Harrison Rubin. That is him lounging right across from me. Our art is by Ross Connard. Thank you so much, Ross.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
Oh, wait, hang on. I'm getting a text from Johnny Words right now. He says, blah, 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 bad takes about Star Trek. Okay, we don't need to address this on the episode right now.
Oh, man, we should do a new segment, Johnny Words, bad takes. No, that's not nice.
But it is, it's weird, mean, because Johnny Words is a pretty smart guy.
He's a very smart guy.
He's a pretty smart guy.
He's a very smart guy.
He's got very good taste. And he's usually a keen and astute observer of fiction and literature and art and pop culture.
He is, yes.
And he has exclusively the dumbest shit to say about Star Trek. Like, I don't understand it. Like, I will agree with him about so many things, except for literally anything he says about Star Trek. And then he's just wrong. And it's not like he likes one Star Trek, and it's not like he loves Enterprise or he loves the JJ movies, but I'm like more of a traditionalist. We like the same ones, but the way that he talks about them is insane to me.
Mostly I'm entertained by the two of you going back and forth, although I do almost always fall down on your side when the piece in question I have actually seen.
He doesn't think the original series cast is hot,
which is crazy.
Is he insane?
Just doesn't understand what sexy is.
Has he only experienced Star Trek as a radio drama? Like, I don't understand it. I do not understand it.
Yeah, it's a whole cast full of really hot people.
Yeah, they're all, the least hot of them is still hot.
Pop quiz hotshot, who's the least hot on the original Star Trek?
It's debatable. Some might say Chekhov is the least hot, but like, he's boyish and adorable. Some might say Jimmy Doohan as Mr. Scott is the least hot. And I would say that is a ruggedly swarthy, handsome man. He's not swarthy.
He's not swarthy.
That is a ruggedly handsome man. And some might say that DeForest Kelly isn't fucking hot as Dr. McCoy. And I say, you're crazy.
That's insane. That's crazy. An insane take.
Anyway, Johnny Words is crazy.
Probably going to cut all of this out.
Much of it.
Yeah.